Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Hello, my friends. Welcome back to our Through the Bible podcast. This is Josh Swanson, lead pastor at Christ Church in Sierra Madre. So today we are launching into the Gospel according to Luke. So who is Luke anyway, and why is he writing a biography about Jesus? So Luke was a travel companion of the famous Apostle Paul. So he was right there at the launch of a number of different churches that Paul was starting. Interestingly, he was a Gentile convert, and so he's actually the only author in the New Testament who is not Jewish. In fact, the only author in the entire Bible who is not Jewish, which is just fascinating. And his gospel, along with its sequel, the book of Acts, because Luke is author of both this gospel as well as the book of Acts, which tells the history of early Christianity and the early Christian movement. Luke is the longest of all of the books in the New Testament. So written by a Gentile, longest of the books. He was a physician. Paul refers to him as the beloved physician. He was a trained doctor. And we know from his writing that he was incredibly intelligent, articulate, and well-educated. Scholars who study Greek have pointed out that the finest, most sophisticated Greek in the entire New Testament is the first four verses of Luke 1. And actually, Luke's gospel is just very sophisticated. When I was in seminary, you know, in learning Greek, they always have you read from John's writings, so the Gospel of John, as well as 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, because they're a lot simpler Greek, kind of like if you're learning how to read, your story is starting to grow, you're going to read, you know, something that's written for, you know, 5th or 6th grader, not something that's written at a college level, you know? And a lot of the New Testament writers are more at that lower age range, kind of like it's written for this kind of person. Luke is not there. Luke is up there kind of much more high school, college writing. So, and why is he writing the story of Jesus? Well, why not let him answer that question in how he opens the gospel? Here it is. Luke 1, verse 1. Inasmuch as many has undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us. So he points out that many people have written stories about Jesus. They've sought to bring together the different sayings of Jesus. Of course, we know at least some of those that he is referring to. There was the Gospel of Mark, which is the earliest gospel. The Gospel of Matthew, which, you know, some people believe was written before Luke, and there were other sources. There's one source that often New Testament authors refer to as Q, which some say, you know, also contained kind of a compile. We just don't have Q, but we can kind of discern that Luke is drawing upon Mark in some places, and Matthew is also drawing upon Mark. And then it seems like in some places, both Luke and Matthew are drawing upon another source that they have access to, but we don't because it's not in the New Testament. So he points out that many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and stewards of the word have delivered them to us. So it's interesting. He points out here, I think this is pretty fascinating. How was it that we got these biographies of Jesus in the first place? You know, sometimes people think about the New Testament in the same way that, let's say, the Mormons think about the Book of Mormon or Muslims think about the Quran. And what is their understanding of the Quran? Well, it's that Muhammad received a series of revelations, which were direct words from God. And he was hearing, you know, these words and he was writing them down. And they were basically the transcribed words of God. And the Book of Mormon, of course, these writings that were found on these golden, or as the story goes, the mythic legend goes, Joseph Smith goes out in his backyard in New York, and there, lo and behold, there's gold tablets, and he translates them using some Urim and Thummim thing, you know, and voila, the Book of Mormon, you know. But that's not the way Christians understand we got the Bible, and specifically the New Testament, specifically the Gospels. And so how did we get the Gospels? Well, they began not with a writer. They didn't begin with a revelation from an angel. The Gospels began with the incarnation of Jesus, when the Word became flesh and walked among us. And Jesus, it began with the event of Jesus Christ, with his birth and his life and his miraculous powers. And he was exorcising demons and he was preaching like no one had ever heard. And then, of course, he died. And most centrally, he was raised physically and bodily from the dead on the third day. He was seen by over 500 witnesses at one time. And then Jesus commissioned those who had seen him to go out and declare to everyone what he had done. They were to be witnesses of the resurrection and also to carry the words of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus. So one other little just point of, I think, historical interest. The first century was not a written culture, it was an oral culture. And so in an oral culture, you don't have, you know, a lot of writings and a lot of people are illiterate. And in the Roman Empire, you know, it was 90% of people were not literate. And so how would you gain access to the things that were said by master teachers? Well, it wasn't because you sat down with a book that you had on your shelf and read it. No, it was because you received an orally passed down tradition. And interestingly, you know, I mean, even like the Greeks and the Romans, for example, Plato believed that oral tradition was more reliable than something written because you could trust the person who communicated to you the truth. And so it was always believed that those who carried like the most important teachings of a well-known, you know, leader like Socrates or a rabbinic figure like Gamaliel or something in his teachings, they would be committed to the disciples of these teachers. They would memorize them and they had much better memories for this sort of thing because they were trained, you know, they had neurological pathways being formed for memorization because that's the culture they lived in. And so they would commit sayings to memory and they would hand them on from generation to generation. And in the first century, what happened? Well, the disciples heard Jesus. They committed to memory the sayings of Jesus. And they also compiled together little, you know, truncated versions of the essence of Jesus's life. Christ died according to the scriptures. He was buried according to the scriptures. He was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. He was seen by the disciples and then by over 500 witnesses at one time. That's a little truncated version of the gospel that we find in 1 Corinthians 15. And it's a saying that was passed on when churches would be established. They would receive a body of oral teaching that originated with the apostles themselves. And there would have to be trusted leaders, elders within the community who would learn that body of oral teaching and then would hold on to it and would transmit it into the lives and hearts and memories of those congregations that were being formed. And so Christianity began, number one, with the event of Jesus. And then number two, the words of Jesus and all that his death and resurrection meant were compiled together in different oral sayings. And as the gospel began to spread, the apostles would take these teachings and sayings to the new churches that were being started in Jerusalem and in Judea and in Samaria and then out into Antioch and into Galatia and all the way into Corinth in Greece and up into Rome. And as the churches were being started, they would receive these sayings of Jesus. And then what happened? Well, as time wore on, you get into the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and what's happening. Well, the original apostles that carried these traditions were getting older. They were beginning to die. The spread of the Christian movement have gone way too far for them to give oversight to all of these many churches. And the stories of Jesus needed to be put down in writing. And that's where the Gospels come in. And so those who were eyewitnesses of the word started to share their messages. And so, for example, Peter, we said when we're going through the Gospel of Mark, Mark wrote down the eyewitness account of the sayings and the deeds and the work of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark, and so too Matthew. And that's what Luke has done. But Luke is interesting because listen to how he describes it. He says, look, it seemed good to me also, You know, there are these other people, Matthew, Mark, so on and so forth, who had compiled together what had been seen and done by Jesus, and they had talked to the eyewitnesses and written this stuff down. Luke said, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things that you have been taught. So Luke says, he'd been traveling with Paul, had interacted with all of, you know, the most important apostles alongside Paul, you know, Peter and James and John. And so he said, look, I took it upon myself to write an orderly account and to investigate all of the right resources, to go to the primary sources, get an accurate historical accounting. And you can just imagine him, for example, you have the birth narratives, it's stories about Mary and Elizabeth going and him interviewing Mary, the mother of Jesus, and like, tell me more about this. And I'm writing a historical account. And he's all about accuracy. And remember, Luke is not, he's an intelligent, sophisticated, well-educated writer. And he's very intent on historical accuracy. He wants to communicate the truth. He wants us to have a firm foundation for our feet so that, as he puts it, you may have certainty concerning the things that you have been taught. And let's just pause and make this point. You know, oftentimes religion is perceived to be simply, it's like ice cream, you know, it's a matter of personal preference. And, you know, some people like vanilla, some people like chocolate, some people like strawberry, and there's not a right or wrong answer. You know, whatever ice cream is best for you, that's the ice cream that's best for you. And some people say, you know, and that's religion, you know. Some people like Buddhism and others Christianity and still others Islam. But whatever is good for you, that's good for you. You know, it deals in the realm of preference. But then on the other hand, we don't say that history is a matter of preference. We wouldn't say, well, you know, some people think that Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president of the United States and presided over the nation during the time of the Civil War. But other people like to believe that that was Washington. And some people, Theodore Roosevelt. And some people like to believe that it was Mickey Mouse, you know. And it's just a matter of whatever preference, whatever you want to believe about that is fine. No, we don't say that at all. We said, no, like the question is what happened, what is objectively true, and what corresponds with reality. And Luke is writing to say that the story of Jesus is actually historically true, that he talked to all of the eyewitnesses, people who saw and experienced the risen Jesus, which, by the way, the only reason why the stories of a crucified Jewish itinerant rabbi in the first century who hailed from the, you know, very unimpressive backwoods town of Nazareth. The reason why Jesus' story was ever told was because something incredibly significant happened that defied explanation. And what Luke says, what Matthew says, what Mark says, what happened was he was physically and bodily raised from the dead. And Luke's saying, look, I checked all my sources and I've gone back and this story of this Jesus is like no one else. And so I've come to share with you that you have a firm foundation for your faith. Now, of course, he's not just writing history. He is writing more than history. He is giving us also meaning surrounding these historical events. He wants us to see that in the story of Jesus, what happened in the life of Jesus was actually, get this, a part of a larger story, the story of God and Israel and God's covenant with Israel. And Jesus comes as the climax of the covenant, as the fulfillment of all of the promises that God made to Israel. And so he tells the story of Jesus in such a way to show us that the story of Israel comes to its climax and realization in Jesus. But Luke also wants us to say that what was accomplished in Jesus namely the inauguration of the kingdom of God in our midst, the turning point of the cosmos, the saving, healing grace of God breaking into this world was not just for Israel, but it's actually for all of the nations. And that's why, beginning in the Gospel of Luke, but then carrying out in the story of Acts, Luke wants us to see that this message about Jesus and all that he accomplished is news for the entire world, not just for Israel. And it was to go out beyond Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and ultimately go to all the peoples of the earth. So Luke is compiling together a historical narrative. He's imbuing it with theological significance and meaning. He wants us to see the significance of the life, of the event of Jesus. And he's writing, he says, for a particular person. This is kind of interesting. He says, "It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time, to write an orderly account for you," he says, "most excellent Theophilus." And you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, who's Theophilus? And why does he get a gospel that's just addressed to him? You know, like, I want, like, what, like, Luke, I thought you were writing for Josh, you know, like, like, is it the story of Jesus? Like, who's Theophilus? And why is, you know, why are you writing for most excellent Theophilus? Well, there's some speculation about who he is. We don't know a whole lot about him. The only thing we really know about him is that when he was born, he had to have been a very, very ugly baby, because oftentimes, you know, you would name a child after kind of like when they were born, like you'd give them a name that associated something like with their birth. And here he's named Theophilus. And it must have been that when he was born, his father and mother looked at him and just thought, this is the awfulest baby I've ever seen. It's so ugly. You know, sorry, that was an ugly, bad joke. But actually, Theophilus means lover of God. So he wasn't an ugly baby. He was a lover of God. And he's called most excellent Theophilus, probably because he was a wealthy aristocrat. Maybe he held some political power even. And maybe he was one of the political leaders that had something to do with Paul's trial. And maybe he's writing a story of Jesus for this wealthy elite ruler. Theophilus was an early convert to Christianity, but he was still a part of the more kind of like ruling elite, wealthy class within Rome. And so he writes, he funds this writing. He's a patron of Luke. And so, you know, writing was expensive in the first century. Most people didn't have access to it. And so Luke is maybe commissioned by Theophilus, and this writing project is funded. You know, he has a donor who's funding this project, and maybe it's Theophilus. So this is commissioned by Theophilus, but ultimately, of course, the message that Luke has is not just for Theophilus. It's for any lover of God. It's for anyone who wants to know about who this Jesus is. So he puts together this orderly account of the life of Jesus. Now, we're going to stop there, and we will pick up next time in Luke chapter 1, verse 5. That was a basic introduction. Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to actually say one more thing about this. So I mentioned earlier, I was about ready to conclude. You're like, man, that was at 18 minutes. That was like one of the shorter podcasts we've heard in a while. Thank you. Those other ones were getting too long, you know, but, so let me just highlight a couple of the key themes that are unique to Luke. So, you know, different gospel writers, they kind of have a thing, like a group they're writing for, a primary audience they have in mind. And Luke, we said, is a Gentile. And we think that Luke is primarily writing for his fellow Gentile audience, and maybe which would include both more aristocratic readers like Theophilus, and maybe some other people who are in the lower class who are coming together in these new communities. You know, the kind of churches that would receive the Gospel of Luke, they were gatherings of people, little collectives of people that up to this point in human history had never been seen together before. And so these early Christian communities, they had Jews who were circumcised, who were faithful, you know, Jews who kept Sabbath and ate kosher and, you know, all of that. And then they had Gentiles, uncircumcised, who didn't practice Sabbath, who didn't, you know, keep kosher. And yet they came and they shared together in the Lord's table. Nobody else was doing that, you know. And then you had, you know, wealthy elite like Theophilus. And then you had bottom of the barrel, the poor, slave class, women and children actually all coming together and eating at the same table, saying we are all on equal footing. And there were not these kind of communities of equality, sharing common commitment and love. And one of the reasons why Luke writes to these kind of new, diverse, multi-ethnic, multi-racial, diverse socioeconomically, communities that are coming together is to show us that Jesus came to form these kind of communities. In fact, one of Luke's main things that he highlights about Jesus is who Jesus shared table with, so that those early Christians might know who they should share table with and who was constantly being welcomed at Jesus's table, treated as a forgiven equal, loved by God. Well, it was the outcasts. It was those who had skin diseases who couldn't be accepted in the temple. It was, you know, the lepers. It was prostitutes and tax gatherers. At time, Gentiles, you know, being brought in to share at the table of Jesus. And of course, Luke tells us these parables of Jesus that none of the other gospels do, that highlight how expansive Jesus's vision was of the kingdom. And so he'll talk about, you know, a host who throws this massive party, and Jesus is invited. And Jesus goes and Jesus confronts the host because he only invites the wealthy, the people who can, you know, increase his status. And Jesus is like, no, no, no. When you throw a party, invite like the poor, the lame, people who can't pay you back. And they should be brought in to the party at the table. And then Jesus goes on and tells these stories like, you know, the story of a guy who goes out and throws this great, you know, wedding feast, this wedding banquet. He sends out all the invitations. The people who are invited don't come. They're like, no, we're too busy. We can't come. Saying like the people who you would think would be invited to the party actually get left out of the party. Then the people who would never be invited to the party. Jesus says, you know, the guy who's throwing the banquet says, go into the highways and byways and compel them all to come in and invite the poor and the lame and the beggars. Bring them all to my table. And then in the Gospel of Luke, you have that classic story of the parable of the two sons. And the irony of that parable is that the one everyone thought would be left out because he took his father's money and ran, spent it all, wasted it in loose living with prostitutes and all this stuff. And he comes back and the father throws a party for his son who comes home. And the son who stayed home and who always kept his nose clean gets left out, while the one who we thought was out is actually brought in. And this is happening in Jesus's ministry all the time. And then Jesus tells another story, of course, about the rich man and Lazarus. And Lazarus, who's always left out, is shown to be brought in to Abraham's bosom. He is included. And so Luke is constantly showing us that Jesus came to form a new kind of community that is inclusive of those who had been formerly excluded. They are now brought in and welcomed into this kingdom. This is a gospel for all nations. This is a gospel for outcasts. And this is a gospel, according to Luke, for women as well. You know, it's interesting. In the first century, women would oftentimes be left out. I mean, they like a rabbi, for example, never had female disciples. And yet who's included in the circle of discipleship to Jesus, but also the women? And in the first century, again, the rabbis, you would never have women sitting at their feet and learning their teaching so that they can carry out that teaching to others. And yet in the ministry of Jesus, we see Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus, and Luke highlights that. And of course, the women are the last to remain faithful at the cross. They are the first to show up at the tomb. They're the first to be commissioned by the risen Jesus to go out and to tell his disciples this good news. And again, it's a group that had been formally excluded from this kind of work and ministry now are being brought in, empowered, and sent out. And so Luke is, he has this unique theme. The gospel is for the outcast, for the Gentiles. It's for women. It's for all people. And I think he's communicating this message both so that those who are in those classes might feel like, yeah, we can be brought in, but also so people like Theophilus can see like, look, what we are doing in our churches, this is not something we're making up. We're not like, Paul didn't come up with this idea. This is rooted in Jesus. It's at the very heart of the kingdom that Jesus inaugurated. It is at the very heart of the kingdom Jesus was embodying specifically in his table fellowship. And so Luke is really trying to bring this theme home. A couple other key themes in Luke. One is Luke talks a lot to us about the power of the Holy Spirit. And he wants us to see that the kingdom that Jesus is inaugurating, this new age that has begun, is the age of the Spirit, where the personal presence of God is at work in and through Jesus and his ministry, and it is poured out on the church and is at work in and through the church. And then again, as we mentioned earlier, Luke wants us to see that the fulfillment of the Old Testament promises of a Messiah, a king who would come, has been finally brought to realization in the ministry and in the person of Jesus. So those are a few of the key themes that we're going to find surface throughout the Gospel of Luke. Now, when we get back together, we will jump into the text of Luke itself. That's enough for now.
Praise Father, Son, and